to the Good Librations podcast. I'm Carla.
And I'm Lauren.
Good Librations is basically the two of us discussing literary topics and genres at length.
A quick monthly reminder to leave us feedback either via the Kiama Library website or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's topic is... Bibliotherapy!
We just wanted to say thank you to the lovely listener who sent us feedback saying, keep up the good work, interesting, informative, and perfect banter and pace. This is such nice feedback. Thank you so much. And we'll definitely do an episode based on the history and evolution of book clubs at some point. So thank you for that fantastic suggestion. And now on to Shelf Absorbed. So I've been reading A Recipe for Family by Tori Hashka. This is absolutely a first world problems sort of book, but in a relatable way. So it's a well-written examination of a modern blended family and the pressures that women put on themselves as wives and mothers and what happens when you add au pairs into the community mix. There's a bit of a lifestyles of the wealthy vibe, but it's very enjoyable and beautifully mixed with fantastic home recipes that add to the overall deliciousness. Tori is one of the authors doing a writing workshop at Kiama in Kiama Library in November, and we're very lucky to have her.
I've been reading... nothing. I was convalescing after a short and unimportant surgery.
Not unimportant.
I just watched Netflix all day long and and just did nothing, and I didn't read anything. So one of the very rare points of my life where there was no book.
No, but you know what?
There was no three books, you know, like...
lots of books.
Yeah.
But I think that this is important to talk about too. It's okay if you're not reading anything.
If you are having a reading slump for whatever reason,
yeah.
I think it's really okay. It's fine.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. You'll get your stories somewhere else, or you'll get your... You'll engage with the narrative in some other way.
Exactly.
And it's fine. Or you just won't, and that's cool too.
And you can just re-listen to all of our podcasts to get your literary fix.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And now on to Shelf Important, where we discuss the topic of the day. So a bit of an unusual one today, and maybe a little shorter too.
Mm-hmm.
One of our library staff suggested this a while back, and we're finally getting to it and learning a lot in the research, really. Today, we are talking about bibliotherapy, or the therapeutic approach that uses literature to support good mental health, which I guess seems a little bit moot, right? Like, of course, literature and the process of reading and engaging in books and stories makes us feel good. We've spoken a lot about why this might be so. Like, talk a lot about... you know, why stories and engaging in stories is so important.
And helpful in just every part of your life.
Apparently not after surgery. But bibliotherapy is very pointed. It's a very conscious practice of reading books, poems, plays, stories, etc. out loud to viscerally offer personal opportunities to explore ourselves and our worlds and to allow ourselves to access and investigate those feelings, those thoughts, those ideas that come up for us when we engage with stories and other forms of literature. So a little history first, and then we'll take a look at the four steps of bibliotherapy. When I first heard about this, I thought, oh, look, another new creative arts therapy. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But bibliotherapy is actually quite an ancient practice. Theoretically, at least, bibliotherapeutic methods, or an acknowledgement of bibliotherapy in whatever form it took, date back to at least King Ramses II. Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, writing sometime around 36 BCE, noted that above the king's book chamber were carved the words, "The House of Healing for the Soul," which I am going to carve that into the wall above our library for real, because it's so beautiful.
That's such a good phrase.
I'm sure it will be fine. I'm sure nobody, nobody at Kiama Council
will blow back whatsoever.
will have a problem with me just like carving a phrase into the stonework above the library.
Oh, dear. So in 1916, Samuel Crothers combined the Greek words for bulk, biblion, and healing, therapia, to describe bibliotherapy as a process in which literature was prescribed as a medicine for a variety of ailments. So we often talk together about the practice in the English classics to take a turn about the garden and convalescing by the sea when you're feeling poorly. So I would like to propose that everyone gets like a monthly bibliotherapy day.
Amazing.
Like would 1000% improve my health for sure.
1000%. And right? I'm sure that it could just be inserted into like our regular sick leave.
Yeah.
You know.
Or maybe like how they have a siesta overseas.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Maybe just like an hour every day.
Oh, yes.
Like on top of lunch break.
Yeah. Not in your lunch break. As well as.
Yeah. So bibliotherapy was used in psychiatric hospitals towards the end of the 19th century and then into the 20th during and after World War I, when there was obviously an increase in demand to treat military veterans post-trauma. In the mid-20th century, there was a shift in mental health treatment from hospitals into the community, with deinstitutionalization significantly changing the way people with mental health concerns were treated. There was a much wider variety of therapy and educational options, with the use of self-help books increasing exponentially. Creative bibliotherapy programs were first delivered in the UK in community settings in 1972, with the US jumping on board in 1991 and Australia in 2010.
Wow.
Like, you guys, it took us almost 40 years since the first implementation. I just find that so
funny.
Why
does that not surprise me, though? I don't know why.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Creative bibliotherapy programs provide an accessible and cost-effective way of filling a well-being niche.
So we've already mentioned creative bibliotherapy, which is one of the four types of bibliotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Creative bibliotherapy often takes place in a group setting, which stories, poems, and fiction are read aloud and discussed by the group.
Mm-hmm.
Developmental bibliotherapy is used in educational settings and by parents to explain childhood and adolescent issues like puberty.
Mm-hmm.
Prescriptive bibliotherapy uses self-help books either in a clinical setting or at home to help modify thought patterns, feelings, and actions. And therapeutic bibliotherapy is used in combination with the other types to manage psychological issues.
Right. So targeted bibliotherapy can be specifically useful for the following issues, and I'm sure many more than these ones we'll mention as well. So anxiety, depression, eating disorders, existential concerns like isolation or death, relationship issues, substance abuse, and it may also be helpful for managing things like anger, socially appropriate behavior, shyness, grief, rejection, racism, sexism, ageism, all the isms. We're always preaching about how valuable books and reading are for literacy and learning, for well-being, and of course for general enjoyment. But you can properly see like how valuable they are when you consider that list. So much insight and perspective to be gained.
There are four steps or stages of bibliotherapy. Identification, identifying with fictional characters, maybe through shared experiences. Catharsis, making a connection with the material, applying what you're learning to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Insight, catharsis brings about insight naturally, allowing comparison between your own experiences and that of the characters, inspiring positive change. And universalization, understanding the material and themes in a universal way, realizing that many people struggle with the same issues that you do, processing feelings and thoughts through follow-up activities and self-actualization.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? There's been so many times during this recording that I've been like, So I apologize, everyone. It's going to be just a podcast full of me going,
You just agree heartily, heartily and quietly. One of the other elements of bibliotherapy that really interests me as someone with a disorderly brain.
Oh my gosh, I did it again. I'm so sorry.
It's only because you're aware of it now.
Yeah, it's true. I have to shush.
One of the other elements of bibliotherapy that really interests me as someone with a disorderly brain, let's say, is how through engaging with storytelling, the brain is kind of tricked into learning how to order thoughts and feelings and how to structure and connect with communication in an effective way. So language has rules, and storytelling has rules, and grammar has rules, and they all have patterns of order and rhythms and structure that they follow in order for the overall story to make sense, and in order for the paragraph to make sense, and in order for a simple sentence to make sense. And so in engaging in storytelling, in reading or in listening to stories, our brains are kind of guerrilla learning how to make sense of language and make sense of stories and of empathy, and then how to communicate that back to the world. So clever.
Mm.
And we kind of already know that because that's how we learn as children when we're learning to read.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it's an often overlooked element of reading as adults as well.
Yeah.
We engage with much subtler stories, and stories which might be structured in quite complex ways, really. And still, it is teaching our brains how to tease out and order the information that we need.
Yes.
And so I was, clever.
Yes. I was just thinking that the reverse of that is true too. So if it's working for adults, then you can see how important it is for children.
1,000%.
Right. So yeah. Like the way that we are, you know, tricking and teaching our brains as adults, and that's working for us, that's like fundamental.
Yes.
To children to have that consistent reading journey.
Yeah.
Like to teach them how to do that through life.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Mm.
And not just like the structure and ability to empathize, but how to just communicate your empathy,
yes.
How to communicate how you're feeling about your feelings, how to access and communicate your feelings as well.
Yep.
Like there's so many facets of it. There's so many elements of it, really.
Yes. So like, it's quite a calming topic to discuss, really. Like it's a legitimate guided therapy approach, but I just love the thought too that you can visit your local library, you can select books in quite a mindful way, and while reading them, identify with them, find similarities, understand that universality that we've talked about of people and their problems, and then have insight into your own. Like mm-hmm. It's a sort of a self-therapy in quite a gentle way, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness, the lady who runs the knitting group, Bonnie, just came into our office and gave us fruit mince tartatin. Did I say that right?
I don't know.
With whipped cream and like a homemade caramel walnut popcorn.
So you all think that we work in a library for the books, but we don't. It's for the snacks.
Merry Christmas to us.
Merry Christmas to us indeed.
Oh my goodness.
Thanks, Bonnie.
I was thinking about some books that like I feel have really helped me through my life, like not ones that I've used specifically for bibliotherapy purposes, but ones that maybe work in the same way, have a similar effect. And I realize, you know what's coming,
oh, yeah.
That I might be repeating some of my favorites here again, but look, you get what you get and you don't get upset. Right?
That's a major tenet of learning in our house.
Yes, right. So, as if I'm not going to mention The Lord of the Rings.
Yes, to the surprise of absolutely no one.
Like, do you even know me at all? So, but the reason that I bring it up this time, I know that it's like the 11th time I bring it up, is because like of how beautiful the language is. So there's nothing in this story where you can say in a literal sense, oh, I can absolutely see how my situation is the same as that hobbit who must throw a ring into a volcano. Like I know that. But of course, the metaphorical journey and quest with the obstacles and joys is something that everyone can relate to. But just specifically, I find the language so beautifully engaging. Like I love that poem, all that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. Like, yes, please.
Oh, so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. Like there's, I mean, like I could keep going with more poetry. Like yeah. I could.
It's genuinely beautiful.
It's like it makes me feel different. When I read something like that, it changes my mood immediately. And like that's just me. But I think we all have those things, don't we? Where we're like it's a big sigh of
Do you think as well, centering, do you think as well for you, do you think that there might be a connection there because your dad loved this so much and gave it to you and was like, you need to love this too.
Yeah. Like that kind of,
you know, like the, it was yeah, in your sort of family. Yeah. The fabric of your family.
Yeah, sure. And it's like that kind of settled return to childhood and right. like the cocoon of childhood.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. Okay, so then the next one that I wanted to mention was the Animorphs series by K.A. Applegate. So this is a huge departure for it. Like, it's totally different to Lord of the Rings, obviously. But it just sort of illustrates, like, how different those things can be that you connect to for different reasons, sure. you know? So it was a middle grade youth series back in the late 90s, and I collected every single one of them from the Scholastic Book Club.
How great was the Scholastic Book Club?
It was,
man.
So good. Right. I paid what for them with my price? Own pocket money. I still have them on my shelf at home, all 54 of them.
Even the cockroach one?
Oh, yeah. Well, like every one of them. All of the like spin-offy books, I kind of I've let those go, but the core series I have retained. They were just so formative for me. Like, this was a time when everyone my age was reading Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley, which like are also great. And I read and enjoyed them, but Animorphs and sort of another couple of adjacent series, like they just blew my juvenile brain to pieces because like, it was that moment of, oh, here's that thing that I didn't know that I needed. Here's a ridiculous action-packed sci-fi that makes me want to be a writer, that deals with all the themes of growing up within like a totally different frame of reference than I'd ever experienced before. And like, I'll just never forget how that made me feel.
They were fairly iconic, I think. I don't know really. I'm racking my brain, and I don't know really that there was anything ever before it for that age group with that level of sci-fi.
Sure.
Like, I think that.
Well, not in the same way. Not in that same kind of serialized.
Yeah.
Funny.
Like, they were here and there. It would come up.
Yeah.
But that.
Like, I that think, extended right, series. Yeah, you're right. And then, so I thought I'd mention too, 488 Rules for Life by Kitty Flanagan. We were talking about this the other day. There's a hilarious video that Kitty made explaining her premise. So we'll pop the link on the website page because it's worth a view. It's so funny. So this is the book that you read or listen to. Kitty actually reads the audiobook versions so perfectly. When you want like a proper relatable laugh, it's observational comedy at its finest. It has the most uplifting tone. For example, like the book is entitled 488 Rules for Life, but it only contains 342 rules. And rule number 342 is overpromise and underdeliver. Like, it's just sort of happy inducing in all the right ways.
I feel like we need more of that too.
Yeah. Do you have some that are kind of have been helpful to you in your life, do you think, given you catharsis or insight or free therapy, essentially?
I mean, of course I do. I think every book and story lover has books that they have that kind of intimate connection to, or a book that they read and reread for catharsis or for whatever reason. So yeah for sure, I do. The Joy Luck Club is the first of mine that comes to mind. Uh-huh. It's the first of mine that comes to mind. I went through a period in my 20s where I just devoured everything Amy Tan had written, and I love them all, but this one remains my favorite. And for me, it really changed how I viewed the world of my mother and her mother and her mother and so on. And it really sparked, I think, a more empathetic way of looking at people's lives, but very particularly at women's lives and very particularly at like prior generations' lives, you know. She has such a particular way of writing, and her tone and her imagery and integrating of the Chinese culture is crafted so cleverly that you don't really realize it, but it's almost like you're being lulled into the story in the same way that you would like a fairy tale. And it feels like folklore, and there are absolutely elements of Chinese mythology throughout her works, but her stories are brilliantly told sort of filial dramas, you know, like about the relationships that we have with our families and more poignantly, the relationships between mothers and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
She really has a beautiful way, Amy Tan, of making motherhood powerful and making mothers human as opposed to just some amorphous mother figure, which, you know, happens, had happened a lot, still does happen a lot in literature. And a really empathetic way of explaining the legacy of decisions women make, and the legacy of culture and the stories that came before on their daughters. So, you know, the decisions and the people that they are before they become mothers, particularly mothers of daughters. And I read it again recently, you know, after I'd become a mother. And if anything, it hits more profoundly than it did before. So it definitely is one for me that I hold very close to my heart. And I get a lot of catharsis, you know, through it.
Sure.
And another one I really love and I always read when I need to have a very good cry is The Last Summer by Steve Kluger, which I've spoken about before, but essentially it's about a young boy named Joey, who lives in Brooklyn in the 1940s, and he starts writing letters to his favorite baseball player, Charlie Banks. And it's just a wonderfully written and wonderfully realized account of their relationship and the kind of zeitgeist of 1940s New York and a little bit of that sort of Hollywood era at its height. And I've mentioned before as well, I have no idea why this book resonates so much with me. On the surface, I don't care about baseball. I don't now, nor have I ever lived in New York, and I wasn't alive in the 40s. Like, I don't really particularly care about Hollywood. Like, I have no connection
to any story sort
of on the surface to any element of this story. But I think maybe it could have been set at any point in history and in any time frame and with any other peripheral characters, and it still would be a deeply affecting story because Kluger nails the vulnerability of childhood and the character development of a man who is forced basically into becoming a father to this kid.
Mm.
Although maybe not because the language and setting is done so well, you know, so maybe not. But I always get to the end of the book just sobbing my little black heart out, which is always a very cleansing thing to do for yourself, I think. You know, I think everybody needs to quite consciously go into being vulnerable in a story and being able to have a cry.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a million of them, really. But the last one is Jane Eyre. You know, which again, I've probably discussed a billion times.
Yeah, that's your Lord of the Rings.
It's my Lord of the Rings. I think it really is.
So different, but yeah.
But it really is one of those books that you never really forget the first time you read it. No, actually, I thought about this recently and I don't think it's the first time you read it. I think it's the first time you actually understand it.
Sure.
So I think you can read it whatever the first time, however many times, 20 times, 30 times. But there is a point with this book where there's an understanding of it, finally.
Sure. Okay.
Because the first time you read it, you kind of go, oh, it's a love story, and then you think about it. But it actually really isn't at all. It's kind of a feminist manifesto, really, and probably the earliest of its kind. Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women had come out maybe 50 years before that, around the end of the French Revolution, and there was a lot of discourse happening in England around the time about, you know, a woman's place in the world and a right to education and a right to personal and spiritual freedom. And Jane Eyre has shades of all of that in there.
Actually, it just reminded me because when I was at uni, I did a literature subject about I can't remember exactly what it was titled. It was like a women's sort of literary liberty, you know, that kind of vibe.
Sure. Yep.
And right. Jane Eyre was one of the books we read, and A Vindication of the Rights of Women was another one that we read.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Which is like amazing.
They're the flip side of a coin. I think those two books go together.
Yes.
And I think it was also one of the first novels to be written in first-person narrative.
Ah.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting. Like, not just in terms of feminist literature, but just for literature in the you know, at all. And therefore, one of the first, if not the first, to explore the intimate psychology, therefore, of the main character.
Yeah, that's true.
And for a book that's currently 176 years old, I think it remains sort of philosophically really relevant to a lot of women's contemporary inner and practical lives.
Love that.
Yeah.
So if you would like to know more about bibliotherapy, you can access a free bibliotherapy course online with the State Library of Victoria.
Oh, that's so cool.
We will pop the link on the podcast page as we always do. for I Just Can't Help Myself today, we thought we'd run through some other words that begin with the prefix biblio. So back in the good old days, the only word we knew that contained the prefix biblio was bibliography, right?
100%.
The bane of every student's existence. I'm
having like trauma flashbacks.
Yeah. The list of sources, of course, that you used in your work. But now there are many others, so we're going to chat about them.
Amazing. So bibliography, you know.
Yep.
Bibliotherapy, you now know.
Yep. Bibliophile is a person who collects or has a great love of books. So me.
Yes.
Yep. Bibliomania, obsessive collecting and even hoarding of books, also applies to me.
Yes.
Right.
Bibliotics, mm-hmm. a scientific study of handwriting, documents and writing materials. Love that.
Yeah.
Bibliopole, a person who buys and sells books, especially rare ones.
Mm.
Did not know that one.
Bibliopegy, the art of binding books.
Ooh. If you're a, like, can you then be a bibliopegist?
Probably.
Yeah, I don't, yeah. Don't hurt yourself.
But yeah. And biblio, of course, can also relate to biblical. So bibliomancy is the practice of foretelling the future by interpreting a passage from a book, especially the Bible.
Mm.
And bibliolatry is excessive devotion and reliance on the Bible and also describes extreme fondness for books in general.
Bibliomancy, loving that. Bibliometrics, a statistical analysis of books, articles, and other publications. I don't ever want to do that. That sounds so boring.
How to make books boring.
Right? Bibliothèque, the French word for library. thanks for joining us today. Don't forget to follow Kiama Library on social media and check out the podcast page of our website for links to everything we spoke about today. And if you have the time, rate and review wherever you can.
Our next topic is going to be stories across time. So we've been bouncing off the sides of this topic a lot this year. We're actually going to dive into it for episode 17. Thanks for sticking with us. See you next time.
Bye.